Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for lending an ear. In this hour, living with a young adult with mental illness, the prices we're paying for medicine, and a new book by a Kentuckian calls out anti-voter decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. First,
anxiety is incredibly contagious.
That's Matilda Ross. She's a senior staff psychiatrist at Boston University Health Services. Dr. Ross got our attention with a New York Times op-ed. It's about anxiety among parents of college students.
The adjustment to freshman year is a big change. People are moving away from home for the first time. They're often in a new city. They're often doing little things like laundry for the first time. And high school has gotten extremely structured, where sort of every minute of the day has a plan or an activity. And high school students don't have to plan their time in a major way. The transition to college is huge. You might have, 10 hours of class that's mandatory a week, and then everything else is you got to plan it. You got to figure out when you're going to sleep, how much you're going to sleep. You got to plan your own meals. No one's reminding me, hey, might be a good idea to have breakfast. Those things are huge. And it takes some getting used to. And a whole lot of people will have elevated anxiety, especially for a little while, and most of them are going to get through it.
Dr. Ross notes in her op-ed that many of today's parents of college students are worried about the anxiety that they're hearing and seeing in their children. Who can blame them? The annual college admissions ritual these days can seem something like an academic Hunger Games. This year's seen the rollout of a simplified free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA, devolve into delays and website glitches affecting where students go to college and whether they go at all. Even the gatekeepers have seemed confused about the new rules. Add to this families grappling with where to send their high school students in the fall as campus protests over the war in Gaza play out at schools across the country. All of this is happening at a time when we're becoming more aware of mental health and more open to talking about it.
Things that people used to put in the category of normal emotions are now getting put in the category of mental health problems.
So I wondered, how does this look on campuses here in Kentucky?
Having read the New York Times op-ed, which kind of speaks to parents to say, if your kids are anxious, that's normal. I mean, I want to speak to parents and say, if you're anxious, that's normal.
Shannon Sauer-Zavala, associate professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Kentucky. Here's how she counsels fretting parents.
You've gone from having all this control and all of this like knowledge about what's going on with your kid to like much, much less. And maybe you've gone from having a great deal of input in terms of like activities and academics, and you don't have that as much. And so it makes sense that you're anxious, right? Uncertainty is one of the biggest catalysts for anxiety. And there's nothing more uncertain than like what your kid is doing right now, miles away at college.
You know, the transition to college is full of so many changes, so many major life adjustments.
Maggie Freeman is a clinical psychologist here at Eastern Kentucky University.
For the college student, obviously they're learning a new way of living. They're taking on some independence. But for their parents, letting go of being the fixer of those things, of being the protector, is a really difficult change for them. And so just as their child is adjusting to a new way of living, new stressors that come with college and living away from home, the parents are having to make that adjustment too. And so that can be really difficult. We see parents going into sort of an anxiety response, either the fight, flight, or freeze response. So it can look pretty different just based on how that anxiety is expressed. But we are seeing a pretty strong increase in that.
UK's Dr. Sauer-Zavala reminds us this is normal.
17 and 18 year olds going off to college, there is really normative you know, differentiation from parents that's going on at that time, really normative, you know, kind of identity development. And at the same time, like, they don't have like fully functioning frontal lobes and like need direction. And so it's a real tough position for parents to have to figure out, like, how much direction do I give? And I think maybe a good way to think about it is, and you have to be honest with yourself when you're asking this question, but, you know, is my checking in, is my, you know, kind of controlling, is my helping, right? Is that more to make me feel better? Or is it really necessary in this moment for my kid?
But cutting some slack for parents, the uncertainties are piling up, and uncertainty is a driver of anxiety.
Maybe the best thing for my kid is just to like let them develop life skills by being responsible for themselves. But what if it isn't? What if it's not? What if I should have swooped in, right? And it's those what ifs, I think, that can be, you know, really uncomfortable. And so it makes sense. You want to seek reassurance, right? And maybe that is reaching out to psychiatrists at the school to say, oh, you know, should I be doing more? Is my kid anxious? Is everything okay? Something that makes people feel more control, feel like they're doing something about it, get a little bit of relief in the short term.
Social media is often cited as a culprit behind anxiety. The social internet has evolved rapidly. The 8 years between 2016 and 2024 might as well have been an eon. On this issue, we found differing points of view.
I personally don't think social media is a huge part of the problem.
Matilda Ross, the Boston University psychiatrist.
It could very well be a little bit different in middle school, but I actually would like to stay with the population that I know better. And in this population, I think by the time they're in college, they mostly know how to handle social media.
I tell myself probably at least once a week, oh my God, I'm glad I didn't go to college in the age of social media. I think it would have made everything so much harder.
UK's Dr. Sara Zavala.
When I am working with my young adult clients, really, like, did someone unfollow me on Instagram? Did, you know, it looks like people are hanging out without me. Should I end my Snapchat streak with this person? Questions that 10 years ago, I don't think would have really been the thing that you'd be talking to your therapist about.
And Dr. Freeman is seeing much the same here at EKU.
There's a whole comparison piece of where they see other people either doing better than they think they're doing, or maybe the other way around. And so adding in that piece of just seeing a constant flow of other people in the same age adds some stressors.
And as a clinical psychologist, how do you deal with that?
The way that we deal with it is just talking through how to consume information in a healthy way. And so understanding that the things that we see on social media are fabricated. It's there for entertainment a lot of times. And so just learning to discern better what is true and what's not true, and helping guide those that we work with to finding what works for them. So indicating what their values are, what their life worth living looks like, and sort of guiding them through that process rather than comparing to what they see online.
So some advice for anxious parents of college students, especially those of you looking at sending your child off to college for the first time in the fall. Psychiatrist Matilda Ross.
Everyone wants to be a great parent, and everyone wants to do everything right. And I think a lot of times people feel like, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. And often just listening is all you need to do. It's honestly my go-to, because obviously I meet tons of people. I've only known them for a couple of hours, maybe, and I have to sort of try to figure out how to help this person. Often my best move is just to listen more and understand what's happening. And often that's what the other person needs. And everybody can do it. You don't have to rush in and try to solve the problem or any of those things. Just listening will do it. So even if you're really worried about whether you can handle it as a parent, just keep your mouth shut. Probably be fine.
UK's Shannon Sauer-Zavala.
The only way to really feel less anxiety is to get cool with feeling anxiety. You have to ride it out and see that it dissipates on its own when the feared outcomes don't actually happen without you doing anything for those thoughts not to be as scary and for you not to have to feel like you have to control it.
EKU's Maggie Freeman.
I think what the first message is that this is so normal to understand that what they're going through, the anxiety that they're experiencing is so normal because it's a sign of a good parent. It's a sign that they've always been there to support their child throughout their lifetime, through all of these hurdles, and to understand that they can still help their child with all of these concerns. It just might look different at this stage of life, and the support that they can provide is so helpful and just as meaningful as everything they've done before, but that they can explore other opportunities to provide resources and really guide their children through this phase of life.
So we've been reminded that college students are growing, evolving young adults who need space to make mistakes and learn from them. Parents of college students are also evolving as they experience sending their children off to a college campus, sometimes very far away from home, and themselves learning how to step back and let go, which is not easy to do. Eastern Standard contributor Chris Beckley wears both hats as a college professor and a dad, and he has some observations to share.
Teenagers and young adults being anxious or struggling with mental health issues is nothing new. Helicopter parents may be a newish term, but parents worrying about their kids and trying to intervene is nothing new. But that doesn't matter. I had malaria once, and it didn't matter to me that we found malaria in Egyptian mummies nearly 5,000 years old. Nobody said, "It's only malaria, that's nothing new." We just took care of it. I'm a college professor, and I have three children, all in high school or college. I have a sense about what makes those young people anxious and how they think about things. I talk about this with my kids and with the students in my classes. I ask them directly what they worry about. While everybody's different and sources of anxiety are surely diverse and unique, there is one broad category of things that worry young people, and that's the future. That's pretty broad and nothing new either. But I agree with those who will not simply attribute broad changes in mental health to social media or smartphones. In my observations, which are extensive but admittedly anecdotal, that's not the problem. I recently wrote a book, The Next Apocalypse, about how we think about the future and about things falling apart. While I was writing this, I interviewed all kinds of people, including young people, about the future and what was worrisome and what was hopeful. Some of the things creating anxiety are big picture things like climate change or the rise of authoritarianism. And the anxiety that these big picture things create is not just a sort of end of the world anxiety, but rather a response to harbingers of an unpredictable future. What do you study? What career might you have? Should you have children? What will the future look like? Right now, many of the answers to those questions are not exciting and hopeful. Some of the things creating anxiety are unique to us here in the U.S. Things we do to ourselves, the price of an education, for instance, or the reality of what being saddled with student debt will do to your plans for the future, the cost of housing, the cost of medical care. I was in Europe once with students and had to take one to the hospital for some minor injury. And as we were leaving, I asked where I could pay. The doctor looked confused for a moment, then smiled and said, "Oh, that's right. You're American. There's no charge here." Well, we have better doctors, we tell ourselves, or shorter waiting times, or our choice of doctor. That could be true. Of course, many people here wouldn't know one way or another. They never go to the doctor. Can't afford to. Now, among students, I've seen a rise in anxiety over the last 10 or 15 years. It's manifested in students losing interest in school or becoming less enthusiastic about anything that doesn't lead directly to a job. Of course, that doesn't work. What led to a job yesterday is not going to lead to a job tomorrow. So this really isn't even about young people. It's about the rest of us and the situation we've left them in. I suppose blaming TikTok and Instagram makes us feel better, but it's not going to help.
Eastern Standard contributor Chris Begley, a father and a teacher of budding anthropologists at Transylvania University.
It's just me and anxiety. It's just me and
Poetry can be found in the life of a parent of an adult child with a mental illness. Eastern Standard contributor Tom Eblin hears about it from his latest guest.
Lynell Edwards is a poet, writer, teacher, and author of 6 collections of poetry. She's Associate Programs Director for the Naslin Mann Graduate School of Writing at Spalding University in Louisville, where she lives. Edwards' most recent book, This Great Green Valley, was published in 2020. It was about some of her ancestors who came to central Kentucky as pioneer settlers in the late 1700s. Her new poetry collection was inspired by modern family struggles. The Bearable Slant of Light, recently published by Red Hen Press, explores mental illness and its impact on the families of those who suffer from it. Lynell Edwards is with us today to talk about her book, The Bearable Slant of Light. Lynell, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
Well, this is a very personal book. What prompted you to write it?
Well, I think that certainly writers are told to write what you know. And for the last 7 or 8 years, this is what I've known. My youngest son struggled with bipolar disorder and the ways in which that has shaped our family and our responses to that, and the ways we've tried to support him and the ways that he's been brave. So I began writing poems about what we were seeing and what we were feeling. This is a book that really documents my experience, our experience, and doesn't try to imagine what he's feeling exactly. And at the same time, of course, it's been a very anxious time in our world. And so there are poems that point towards our general anxieties about things in our world that are difficult. And because I'm a student and teacher of literature, I look to the literary historical record for constructions, depictions of unwellness and mental illness, and was surprised at what I found there, and use, in some cases, characters from literature and history to also tell that story.
Well, you know, these topics are often written about in memoir or sometimes in nonfiction. Poetry is a little bit of an unusual construction for things like this. How did you kind of go about it? Did you find many models for it?
Well, one thing that anyone who might be familiar with my work prior to this, or certainly the book that you described, will find this a little bit more experimental in its method. Poems just flat out look different on the page. And in some ways, that mirrors the erraticness in the trajectory of mental illness as well. So putting the book together was a different kind of puzzle than it had been. I do think that, you know, among contemporary poets, you do see some writing about mental illness, often from the point of view of someone who themselves struggled. There's a really exciting book about 3 years old, a collection of poetry called Odes to Lithium. And it's by a young woman who also was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And she writes about that from her perspective. So my choosing to write as the parent is a little bit different. But for me, the greatest difference was just the approach to the poems themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were you hoping to achieve with the poems?
Gosh, well, on the one hand, that I could say something true. And the stakes were high for me with this book in terms of getting it right, because it was material and a subject so dear to me and so complicated that it was really important to get it right. I have shared the collection with my younger son, and his response was measured but positive. Parts of it were hard, parts of it were accurate, and I was glad to get a kind of blessing from him that it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what I hope to accomplish, I do hope this will start some conversations. I do hope that this will be a way, perhaps for people who hadn't considered poetry as a place where they might find their experiences represented, would consider, oh, a book of poetry about the kinds of things I've experienced, and that it would be a way for people to see themselves, which I think is what we hope for generally with literature. So we shall see.
Well, read something for us from your book.
Okay. So I'm going to read the very first poem, which is a kind of prelude. And when I mentioned that there's a more experimental method here, this poem wouldn't look like a poem to anybody. It appears in a kind of solid block on the page with a lot of white spacing to indicate what usually might be considered line breaks. But it's also kind of polyvocal, several voices here. And it's called Medical History Number 2. There is no medical history number one in the book. And it begins with a little epigraph, a snatch of dialogue between myself and a doctor who had called me when he was hospitalized. And I say to the doctor, me, I think there's a lot of trauma he has to process. And Dr. K says, did something happen? Medical history number two. The hospital happened. The involuntary happened. The injectables happened. They had to rip his shirt. The doctors, the nurses, the residents, the techs happened. The other patients, some of them pacing in the hall and loud. The first attempt happened. The one-on-one happened. The EEG happened. The ambulance happened. None of this is in any kind of order, you understand. The restraints and psychosis, the overdoses and non-compliance, the catatonia, the mania happened, the loneliness, the isolation happened, so many, many different meds. The assessments and telehealth happened, more ambulance happened, the courts happened, the ECT happened, the second attempt happened, the social workers happened, the intensive outpatients and treatment teams and therapists happened. 7 years happened. He won't get them back.
That's very powerful.
Thank you.
How did writing this book help you cope?
Oh, boy. I think there were two different sides to my brain, honestly. I don't know that exactly helped me cope, because in a way it puts the distance a little bit at arm's length, because writing about something in kind of a personal journal sort of way, which is actually not something I've ever done, can be therapeutic. I would write these poems, and that last poem that I read actually happened very quickly, immediately following that conversation. And there would be a kind of getting out of it, but then the process of shaping it into a poem means I have to put it slightly at arm's length and think about, what does the poem need? What is the poem being? What is this thing that I'm crafting here? And that's where you have to let go of it a little bit. So I'm not sure that's even probably psychologically healthy to objectify your emotions, but I'm out of my pay grade on psychology at this point.
Well, you know, so many families struggle with family members with mental illness. How do you hope that perhaps reading these poems can help them?
I think, again, to help them see themselves. And I've had the experience of starting to share some of these. And every time I do, someone does come up to me and say, you know, my father, brother, nephew, niece, daughter, stepdaughter really struggled with this. And as an adult, and I think that the adult child is a particularly difficult case for this. There is quite a lot of much needed attention right now on adolescents and children and mental illness, but it's an entirely different situation when that child turns 18. And so I hope that families will see themselves in this and, again, start conversations and begin to help discover better answers for this very, very complex situation than we have right now, which is partially about resources, but not entirely about resources.
Well, sometimes it doesn't really seem like the medical establishment entirely knows what it's doing either with this. I mean, these are such mysterious illnesses.
They are mysterious illnesses. And the reasons the medications work or don't work are often mysterious, because in one of the poems, the long poem I document, it's not clear, and the patients themselves aren't always good, quote, historians of what's going on. So it's a very tricky situation. The person's a kind of black box in terms of understanding what's happening, really.
Yeah, yeah. Once again, this book is The Bearable Slant of Light by Louisville poet Linnell Edwards. Linnell, thanks for being with us today.
Very good to talk to you, Tom.
For the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, this is Tom Eblin reporting for Eastern Standard.
When we come back in a moment, scrutinizing what you're paying for those meds.
There is no such thing as straightforward pricing in the medicine world. And there are a litany of intermediaries that have their hands in the proverbial cookie jar.
And Josh Douglas, host of our election year series Democracy Optimist, is out with a new book on how decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court have stacked the decks against American voters.
They are the lifeblood of our democracy.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. The Living Arts and Science Center's Lost Arts Club will present a candle-making class 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. May 14th at the Center. This adult class will teach the art and science behind candle-making and experiment with different fragrance combinations. The class is $20 for members and $25 for non-members. For more information, visit lasclex.org. Pioneer Playhouse in Danville kicks off its season with The 39 Steps, adapted by Patrick Barlow from the John Buchan novel and the Alfred Hitchcock motion picture. Performances begin June 7th and run through June 29th. For more information and tickets, visit pioneerplayhouse.com. To learn how to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When it comes to healthcare, there is a lot of unease among consumers about costs and a sense that there isn't much anybody can do about it. Seems as though there's this disconnect between the current system of healthcare pricing and consumer expectations given the economic realities of life today in the U.S. Prescription drugs, for example. A new analysis is raising questions about a federal program that, according to our guest, results in patients drastically overpaying for their prescriptions. Antonio Chacha is CEO of 46 Brooklyn Research. It's a nonprofit corporation that works to make drug pricing data more accessible and more user-friendly. Thanks for joining us, Antonio.
Hey, great to be with you today.
And briefly for our listeners, if you would first tell us a little bit about 46 Brooklyn. What do you do?
We're drug pricing nerds. I got my start in the pharmacy world in Ohio and was asking questions of our state Medicaid program at the time, why pharmacies were being paid for so little for medicines. And they looked at me like I was crazy and they said, we're paying more for medicines than we ever have. And so we started to unlock the previously untapped potential of publicly available drug pricing data and ultimately helped the state of Ohio uncover $245 million in waste within our state Medicaid program, where insurance intermediaries called pharmacy benefit managers were buying low, selling high, and pocketing the difference. Since then, we have dedicated our time and energy to demystifying prescription drug pricing such that we can hopefully eliminate some of its waste.
Well, in your literature that was provided to me for background, you say that your organization believes the complexity of drug pricing has created serious consequences for payers, patients, and providers all across the country. Talk to us about that complexity.
Well, in healthcare, everything's expensive, right? Everything from medicines to surgeries. But when you look at all the things that we can buy in healthcare, pharmaceuticals should be one of the most straightforward. You know, you walk up to a pharmacy counter, we know the drug that's going to be used, we know the quantity of tablets and capsules in the bottle, we know how much the bottle and the label costs, and in general, we know how much it costs a pharmacist to perform their services. So from an overly simplistic perspective, it's the easiest thing we buy in healthcare. Yet there is no such thing as straightforward pricing in the medicine world. And there are a litany of intermediaries that have their hands in the proverbial cookie jar who add layers and layers of complexity, which become a black box because nobody wants you to know how much they bought it for because they want to be able to sell it for as much as humanly possible.
Now, your most recent analysis focuses on a federal program known as 340B, and you say that it was created with good intentions, but in the end, it's resulted in increasingly inflated prescription prices and massive prescription markups paid for by sick patients and their health plans. Tell us more about that.
340B is an important program that many have never heard about, and it plays a major role in what we all pay for medicines. It was created about 30 years ago, essentially designed to be the Robin Hood of healthcare. What it does is it gives medicines at a steep discount to what we call covered entities, which are like hospitals or federally qualified health centers. The idea is we give them super cheap medicines such that they can sell them at a huge markup and use the yielded profits to invest in care for those who can't otherwise afford it. So on its surface, it is meant to provide medical services and other types of services to patients who can't afford them, which sounds fantastic. But it then begs the question, how are the dollars created? And unfortunately, what happens is a hospital receives these drugs for big discounts. In our most recent analysis, we look at a vial of insulin where a hospital will buy it for 10 cents, even though the going rate is around $300. So after they buy that drug for 10 cents, they then sell it on the open market for $300, and they make around $290 and change on as profits for themselves. The problem there is that while those dollars could be used to provide medical services to others, we are asking a more fundamental question, which is who had to overpay in order to create those dollars in the first place?
What did you find to be the cause of the program straying from the original intent of helping patients access medications at prices they can afford? What's at the bottom of this?
The program itself is built on the idea that we will take from one to give to another. And look, I come from the pharmacy world where, you know, I've seen patients that walk up to a pharmacy counter, and if they have to pay $5 for some, that is an untenable situation. I've seen many patients leave their prescriptions because they can't afford it. Yet the entire premise of the 340B program is to create cheap medicines but not actually make them cheap for the patient who needs them. So as the program grows significantly, today it is actually larger than the Medicaid program, which is built to provide care for the most vulnerable and poor in every state across the country. 340B has actually eclipsed that program, meaning that the impact on the broader marketplace and the patients who ultimately overpay to feed that program becomes more and more significant with every inch that the program grows.
Is there any work underway in Washington, in the bureaucracy or in Congress or both, to fix this?
In general, there is a culture of accountability that is starting to grow, not just within the 340B program, but in drug pricing at large. The truth is that drug companies set huge, very inflated prices for medicines. And they do so with an understanding that they have to give huge discounts away to PBMs, insurance companies, Medicaid programs, and the 340B program. So whenever the drug companies are told you have to give a discount, understand they can set whatever prices they so choose. So these discounts end up finding their way back into the list prices of the drugs, or more simply put, our demand for discounts is largely driving prices higher than they otherwise would be. So we all have to grapple with higher prices in order to create the environment conducive to give these discounts away in the first place. So the federal government is starting to ask more fundamental questions, which is, what is the cost of these discounts, right? Are they being disproportionately felt by underserved or underinsured patients? What's happening to employers? Are they getting a rotten deal if others are getting a better deal, et cetera, et cetera? So the challenge now is,
how do they actually go after resizing these programs when they've been built on our addiction to discounts, built off bloated, inflated prices? So there's an awareness for a need for change, but I'm also pessimistic that they lack the intestinal fortitude to go through the hard work of changing policy, since the system also yields winners next to its losers.
Antonio Chacha is CEO of 46 Brooklyn Research. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
As a law professor at the University of Kentucky, Josh Douglas sees it as his job to illuminate important flaws in our democracy, and he's written a book, The Court Versus the Voters, on how decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court have stacked the decks against the American voter. Josh writes and hosts our special election year series, Democracy Optimist, and you can find his growing track list of episodes on our site at esweku.org. Just click on the Democracy Optimist tab there. Welcome to the other side of the microphone, Josh.
Thanks. Good to see things from this perspective.
So there's something I think we ought to clear up before we dive into this discussion. I think most people assume that voting is a very basic, fundamental citizen's right that's enshrined in the Constitution. Is that correct?
Not exactly. The U.S. Constitution does not explicitly protect the right to vote. I think that's something that surprises a lot of people. The Supreme Court had recognized the right to vote under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, that principle and ideal of equality. And there's a long line of cases in which the court has said the right to vote is a fundamental right. These cases, you know, are from the 1960s, generally, the Warren Court. And as I discuss in the book, there's been a significant pullback on that today. But the answer to your question is the U.S. Constitution does not actually explicitly confer the right to vote.
Now, your book is about law written by a lawyer, so many non-lawyers out there might reasonably assume that it's going to be a tough read, that you'd need to be a lawyer to read it. But I know that you've gone to lengths to make it accessible to everybody. How'd you do that?
So I focused on stories, and that's really important to me because I agree that most people who hear that there's a book by a law professor and it's about the law might find it theoretical, might find it difficult to read. And one of the greatest compliments I received about my first book called Vote for Us and what I tried to do in this book was to make it accessible to everyday voters because, look, they are the lifeblood of our democracy. And the way I did that is through stories. So I tell a lot of stories in the book about people I found really interesting after interviewing them, people who brought lawsuits trying to challenge voting rules, lawyers who took on the good fight all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and even some stories about some of the justices themselves as well. I dug into the archives of the Supreme Court's papers and listened to the oral arguments of the cases, all trying to weave together a narrative about these people, because ultimately these cases affect people and all of us.
That's right. We have some very big ones before the court right now that could be, I don't know if I call them life-altering, maybe so.
Yeah, but it could be. I mean, certainly the Trump immunity case
absolutely.
Is a major one that could really impact, you know, a lot of democracy moving forward.
Well, in the introduction of your book, you cite polling that shows that a majority of Americans trust the Supreme Court to protect democracy. But you state flat out that the Supreme Court of the United States is anti-democracy and anti-voter and has been for far longer than we think. Very bold statement, especially considering that 60 years ago, the Supreme Court declared among American rights the right to vote was one of the most fundamental, the very foundation of democracy. Can you condense it for us? How the Supreme Court has become anti-democracy?
Yeah, and you know, that polling suggests that the courts, the people's perception of the court has been higher and it's gone down, but it still is the institution that I think most people think of as a protector of rights. The problem is that the court is not been so, at least when it comes to the constitutional right to vote. And it's not just a recent development. You know, a lot of people have heard of some cases like Citizens United, the 2010 case about campaign finance, Shelby County, a 2013 case about the Voting Rights Act, or even Bush v. Gore, which ultimately resolved the 2000 presidential election. But I trace this case law back to the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s, and I talk about cases that laid the foundation for the court today to underprotect the right to vote. And that's really, I think, important and interesting. The court is not coming out and saying we're not protecting voting rights. It's doing so in much more subtle ways. And it's pointing to these cases from the 1980s and 1990s to say, hey, look, we're just following precedent. But if you peel back the onion and look at those cases, you see the court has really undermined the protection of the right to vote through some tests that the court set out in those cases.
Well, you also say that the Supreme Court is anti-voter, which makes it kind of personal. Why should we believe that the U.S. Supreme Court is against us?
Well, because previously the court used to scrutinize state voting laws to make sure they did not infringe upon the right to vote for everybody, and that states had a really good reason, a really strong justification for protecting for regulating the election in the way the states wanted to. The lawyers would know this as called strict scrutiny, a very close judicial test where the court scrutinized state voting rules. But today, the court doesn't do that. Instead, the court says plaintiffs who bring cases, you have to show a ton of evidence that a law burdens the right to vote. And at the same time, states, we're not going to really require you to make much of an argument as to why you want to have your election rules as they are. It's what I've referred to as undue deference to state legislatures, undue deference to states in their voting rules. And so now states can say things like, well, we just care about election administration, or we're concerned about election integrity. And the state doesn't have to provide any evidence at all that its voting laws actually achieve those goals. So it's kind of flipped. It used to be that the voters could show, hey, this law is going to harm the right to vote, and then the states would be put to the test to prove why it needed that law. Now the voters have a high burden to show the evidence of infringement of the right to vote, and the states don't really have to say much to get the court to approve its laws.
You make the observation in the book that people often underestimate the impact of cases involving voting rights, which you say add up to a sustained attack on democracy, and that your intention with this book is to change that. Tell us more about that.
So I think often we look at each case in isolation. We hear about a case and, you know, we might think that the ruling is wrong because it's trusting politicians too much. And by the way, voting rights is the one area where we should trust politicians the least, because they're so self-interested to enact voting rules to help keep themselves in office. So we look at, you know, one case in isolation, but when you add them all up, you see that there's a sustained underprotection of the constitutional right to vote. So I'll give you just a quick example of the first couple of chapters. Chapter one is about a case from 1983 called Anderson versus Celebrezze, a case no one's really heard about. But the court there started to pull back on this close judicial scrutiny of the constitutional right to vote. Then you get in 1992 a case called Burdick versus Takushi about this guy Alan Burdick's desire to write in a candidate because he didn't like any of the choices on the ballot. And again, it's a case no one's really heard of, but the court furthered that test from Anderson and again placed the thumb on the scale of the states in favoring states. And now you have what's known as the Anderson-Burdick test, these two cases. And so cumulatively, you see that when you look at them in combination and you look at the evolution, the history over the past 40 or 50 years, you see today the court fails to protect the constitutional right to vote in the way that I think we should if we want a robust democracy where everything starts with the voter.
Three big cases that you've touched on seem to loom over elections and voting. There's Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court ruling that gave the 2000 presidential election to George Bush, even though Bush had not received the most votes nationwide. Citizens United, the court held that the Freedom of Speech Clause of the First Amendment bars the government from restricting independent expenditures for political campaigns by corporations, nonprofits, labor unions, and other associations. And then Shelby County versus Holder that gutted the protection of the Voting Rights Act. All enormous cases. But you argue that even if these rulings were overturned by Congress, which in the current circumstances seems highly unlikely, it wouldn't fix our electoral problems, that we need to dig deeper into the past to understand what's happened. Take us there. Which Supreme Court cases do you focus on in the book?
In total, I look at 9 cases over the past 50 years, as well as Chapter 10, I call the next looming case. You know, the case I think, or the issue I think, is coming down the pike that could impact our elections. But again, if you just look at one of those cases, Bush v. Gore, which, of course, you can't really overrule the decision. George W. Bush was president. But there are principles from that case that are harming the way we run our elections today. Or Citizens United about, as you mentioned, campaign finance, which I actually see as a voting rights case, because what it does is it makes the voter have less of a voice. Their voices are drowned out by the sheer amount of money in politics. Or Shelby County about the Voting Rights Act. If you just reverse one of them, or really all three, that doesn't get to the heart of the matter, which is that the court is trusting politicians too much to do the right thing in voting rights in the very area where they're self-interested to try to entrench themselves in power. So, yeah, you could overturn one of these cases. Congress could pass a law overturning them. And, you know, I don't think that would be a bad thing. But that doesn't get to the systemic problem of this underprotection of the ideal of the constitutional right to vote and this over deference, this undue deference, this overtrust of state politicians when it comes to voting rights.
You talk about John Anderson in the book, and for any of our listeners who are not familiar with who that was, unfortunately, some of us are old enough to know who John Anderson was. But who was John Anderson? What's his connection to voting rights?
Really interesting individual. And again, as I mentioned, the book is about stories. So I tell his story, and I learned a lot of really interesting things about him. He grew up in Rockford, Illinois. He was a member of Congress for a number of years, I think about 20 years, a moderate Republican. And he decided to run for president in 1980, initially as a Republican, but he saw the writing on the wall that he would not receive the nomination. So he decided to run as an independent. The problem was he made this decision in the spring of 1980, and several states' ballot deadlines had passed, that is, to get on the ballot as an independent candidate. So he sued. He challenged these laws. Now, he was ultimately allowed on the ballot, but the case, in terms of whether the laws were constitutional, went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the court issued its decision in 1980. And here's, I think, something interesting and tells you about the subtlety of how this has happened. John Anderson won his lawsuit. The court ruled that the state laws were unconstitutional, that they should have been allowed to be on the ballot. But in doing so, the court started to pull back on the strict judicial scrutiny of the right to vote. And so the court sets out this balancing test in which you balance the burden on voters with the state's interest in a law. And that's, I call that chapter the beginning of the end, because it was the beginning of the court pulling back on this strong scrutiny of state voting rules through this balancing test. And then, as I mentioned, the next case, Burdick, embellishes that test even further.
Well, Josh, the book is coming out soon, and you're going to have a launch event coming up. Can you give us details?
Yeah, on May 14th, it's a Tuesday, May 14th at 7 p.m., I'll be at Pivot Brewing here in Lexington to have a kind of a party to celebrate the book coming out. I'll give a little details about the book and excited to meet some readers on the day that it launches.
All right, that's Josh Douglas, research professor of law in the Rosenberg College of Law at the University of Kentucky, also host of the Eastern Standard series Democracy Optimist and author of The Court Versus the Voters, How Decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court Have Stacked the Decks Against the American Voter. Thanks and good luck, Josh.
Thank you so much.
Josh Douglas will be back next week with the fifth episode of Democracy Optimist, the thinking positive title of our election year series on election law and voting. Next week, is the voting booth heading to your smartphone?
So it has been used in 5 states so far, in West Virginia, in Utah, in Colorado, in Washington State, and in Oregon.
We'll learn more from Nimit Sawhney about his company that's trying to revolutionize our voting system through an app using the blockchain. We'll hear about efforts to help sort through the nation's myriad state voter ID laws.
Voter ID laws cause an enormous amount of confusion, and that confusion in and of itself can be a deterrent from people going to the polls.
Lauren Kunis of Vote Writers formed to bring more American citizens into the democratic process.
14.5% of voting age Americans lack an unexpired photo ID, like a state ID card or a driver's license, that has their current name and address on it. Looking at current census numbers, that was upwards of 34.5 million voters.
And you know how it's gotten so we just don't dare talk politics anymore?
In today's day and age, it's hard to believe that we have common values with people that we think we're so opposite from, but in fact, we do have common values, and we want to try to help people get in touch with those and see what they have in common with the other side so they can build on it.
Carolyn DuPont, Kentucky State Coordinator of the grassroots group Braver Angels. They host workshops that bring into one room people with opposing views on politics and policy. There was a time when elected officials mostly agreed to disagree agreeably. Not so much these days. How do you keep things civil in a room full of people who so fundamentally disagree?
It's a great question. So the key to having these kinds of conversations is having structures in place that prevent them from going off the rails. Online, on social media, certainly when we encounter one another in spaces where these are not in place, people feel free to let their worst self kind of loose and feel free to vent. And this is not that. So we'll be holding people to talking about the question that we put out there, asking them not to go beyond those questions. You know, occasionally we have something that feels a little uncomfortable, but it's never irreparable and it's never destroys what happens.
It's all on next week's episode of the Eastern Standard special series, Democracy Optimist. You can stream and download previous episodes of the series from our site, esweku.org. Just click on the Democracy Optimist tab. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Special thanks to the Ramones for their song, Anxiety, and to JVKE for his song, you guessed it, Anxiety. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more, and you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.